Today, you may be forgiven for thinking that Inland Visions have gone international and that we're in Versailles in France, but we are in fact in Peterhof, not too far from Russia's northern capital. It can trace its history back 300 years, all the way back to Peter the Great, but people are still coming here today to enjoy stunning gardens and fountains, so let's check it out. Voila. Now, the fountains here in Peterhof are certainly magical, as you can see, but unfortunately, they don't start by clicking your fingers. Let's go and find out how they really work. Alexander, nice to meet you. I'm hoping you're going to tell me all the secrets behind how the fountains work.
We'll now go to the heart of the fountain area. Its most secret place behind the scenes.
Awesome, let's do it. Now, Alexander, large parts of this system are still original from the 18th century. Now, some of it's been modernized. How much of it is original and how much have you had to change since it was built?
Most of the equipment that we use, the pipes and valves, are from the 19th century. Some were restored in the 20th century after the war. But these are mostly old cast iron lead pipes.
Wow. And for more than 300 years, this whole system, this whole hydraulic system, has worked without a single pump. How does it work? Where does the water come from?
We take water from about 30 kilometers away. Water comes from lakes, ponds, springs, rivulets, and directed into canals and aqueducts that lead to Peterhof. There used to be a river here which flowed into the Gulf of Finland. That was also used for the fountains. We do not use pumps or water lifting machines. Our system is not cyclical. Since the water comes to us from above, it continues flowing in a natural way using gravity and splashes out through the fountains before going into the Gulf of Finland.
When viewed from the outside, the fountains create incredibly complex patterns like a bouquet, a basket, a cake. How do you do it?
All this happens here, out of the public eye, in a similar fountain heart, where each individual jet can be regulated with its own valve. By adjusting their heights and changing the geometric shape of the fountain nozzles, we can give meaning to each fountain, some kind of symbolism. We also regulate and adjust its height, depending on the wind. We don't want to douse our visitors in water, and all this is done manually, just as it was 300 years ago.
Wow, it looks like a metal heart where all the fountains are powered from.
Well, that's actually what it is. It has the same functionality as the first one.
Well, Alexander, it's a bit cold and dark down here. Let's go back into the sun. So at 10 a.m., Alexander, every morning you start the fountains, come rain or shine, manually. Have you not thought about automating it so you can have a lie-in one day?
I feel that if you started adding mechanisms, pumps and filtration systems, it would make it more complex and less reliable. For example, the central part is currently overseen by only 4 people. I consider that to be a very small number, considering we have about 150 fountain jets just in the center, if we count each stream.
And is it true that you and your colleagues, you time each jet with a stopwatch? Why do you do that?
The water we use for the fountains is stored in ponds behind the Grand Palace. The water requires a different amount of time to reach each fountain, so we have these time delays. But if we take them all into account properly, the entire central part rises smoothly and majestically simultaneously, sometimes to music. So it's always a very painstaking task.
There's a real science behind it.
Yes, it's true. Both science and technology are always at play.
That's awesome. So let's go to the next area. Now, it's no secret that tourists all over the world love throwing coins in the fountains. Do they do that here in Peterhof, Alexander? And if so, how much do you collect and what do you spend it on?
I work on the central part. Our most prominent fountain is the Samson Fountain, which is surrounded by a deep basin. All the coins that tourists throw into it immediately end up at the bottom of the pool. The most they can do is please the fish that live in our pool. We don't get our hands on them.
So you don't have any divers with aqualungs, no?
No, they're covered by silt in a week, and you won't see them anymore.
I wonder how much is down there, treasure.
It's like some kind of treasure trove.
They'll find out one day, thank you. Sergei, nice to meet you. Thanks for finding the time to speak to us today. Now, Peterhof is often compared to Versailles. Do you think that's a fair comparison?
That comparison's only partially true. Indeed, at the beginning of the 18th century, the main famous residence was Versailles, which was built by Louis XIV on the site of his father's hunting castle. The king would go out into his park with his magnificent palace behind him. He'd watch water rising from fountains in the central part, but as soon as he turned away, the streams would stop and fall. The fountains would be shut off. There wasn't enough water. Peter the Great spent a whole month in Versailles. When he returned from France, Peter the Great wanted to create a park here, on a par with Versailles, on the shores of the Baltic. In 1720, underground water sources were found 20 kilometers from Peterhof, 85 meters above sea level. They sat down and did the calculations, and it became clear that if the water was brought down through a channel, it would flow exactly to Peterhof. And that's what happened. That way, without a single pump, the water soars up by itself. And there's another important difference between Peterhof and Versailles. When you walk out into the Versailles grounds, you realize that everything there was created for love, pleasure, and aesthetics. Here in Peterhof, when you see that there's a 20-kilometer canal behind you, and that you're standing on the shore of the open Baltic Sea, you understand that everything here was created to symbolize the greatness and power of the Russian state.
Now, this palace, Sergei, is seen around a dozen monarchs. How has that affected the design and the styles of all the different rooms that we've been through?
Peterhof is 200 years of Russian history. The times when Russia was ruled by the Romanov dynasty, starting with Peter I and ending with Nicholas II, come to life in its palaces and parks. Of course, tastes and styles changed over that period, while new challenges, both domestic and political and geopolitical, constantly emerged, and every Russian monarch needed to demonstrate their intentions. For example, after Peter I, his daughter Elizabeth expanded her father's palace, and Baroque art reigned within its walls. In Elizabethan Baroque, everything is in gold and reflects the superiority of the absolute monarch. On coming to power, Catherine II did not set out to change all the halls, only a few. She ordered that the gilded Baroque decor be removed, while the architect Feldman replaced it with a new design in a classical style, that had become fashionable at court. That style was an appeal to antiquity.
Now, whichever hall or room we've been in, Sergei, there's certainly a feeling of pomp and ceremony. It's very upbeat. I mean, there's a huge banquet table here. Is it true that not a single monarch died here?
Peterhof is a celebration of life. Indeed, no head of state has ever died here. People came to Peterhof to enjoy themselves. In the 19th century, during Nicholas I's reign, the French envoy, Astolphe de Custine, traveled through Russia, criticizing everything he saw. But when Custine was invited to Peterhof, he visited the palace. When leaving at midnight, it was still as bright as day in the park. There was no electricity in those days. The illumination was created by myriad colored glass bowls filled with wax. And when Custine saw all this splendor, he rejoiced like a 15-year-old boy. In 1723, Peter first invited representatives from all the diplomatic missions in Russia. They entered here through the sea channel and saw the majestic panorama of the Grand Palace and the waterfall structure at its base. After that, no one dared to ask, where is Russia anyway? They went to Russia and had to reckon with Russia. That's why Peter the Great built Peterhof.
So Peterhof was devastated during World War II, Sergei, and the Nazi occupation. But you can't tell by how immaculate everything has been restored. How have you managed to do such a good job?
That was indeed one of the most tragic pages in Peterhof's history. There have been all kinds of catastrophes on this land, floods, fires, etc. But the biggest tragedy took place during the Second World War. Before the Nazis managed to enter Peterhof, our predecessors, the keepers of Peterhof's treasures, had already accomplished an amazing feat. They had 3 months to evacuate the nation's cultural heritage. They managed to carefully pack about half of the collection in boxes and take them inland. Afterwards, Wehrmacht troops and Allied soldiers were stationed here for 2.5 years. Moreover, in 1944, when the Red Army was advancing from Oranienbaum, the retreating Nazis blew up the central part of the palace along with the Grand Cascade. Only charred walls remained of the building's former grandeur. And then, once again, in yet another page in the history of the Russian state, Peterhof demonstrated the valor, courage, and power of the Russian people. Restorers, historians, and museum staff first studied and then carefully recreated the parquet, millimeter by millimeter, as well as the gilded decor and Dutch ovens. And in general, all this was done with the same 18th century technology used originally, so that today, you and I don't notice the difference. Consequently, we can still travel back 3 centuries, as if in a time machine, to catch a glimpse of authentic Russian history.
And finally, Sergei, there's obviously 150 fountains, some of which you can see outside there. Is it true that Peter the Great himself designed some of the fountains and also hid some surprises, some secrets in there and had a bit of fun with them? What can you tell me about that?
Trick fountains are, in fact, a very ancient form of fun. It comes from the Italian, giochi d'acqua, or water games. In ancient times, it was believed that spring water coming up from the ground showed the way to the underworld. And it was believed that if a tired traveler, overjoyed at finding an underground spring, drank and immediately lay down to rest, he could be dragged through that very hole into the afterlife. And from this, they came up with the idea for trick fountains, which were supposed to wake up a tired traveler. That's why you can find fountains like this in Italy. Then this fad moved to Germany and France, and finally, Peter the Great ordered the creation of trick fountains in Peterhof Park. A whole section for water, a whole section of the park alley. Ladies, chic dresses, crinolines, men wearing doublets worth several villages. And then, with a secret sign from the emperor, A canopy of water emerged from both sides, with jets streaming high and low. It was impossible to escape. Or they might go into the lower grotto to hide from the sultry sun and find a table with soft drinks and fruit on it. Of course, they wanted to go over and take them. But jets would start spewing water at them from the edge of the table. There was nothing malicious in it. It wasn't the result of some wicked sense of humor on Peter the Great's part, but rather of his attitude towards his subjects.
Right, so I've heard a lot about these trick fountains, and you can see them behind me now. There's a tree one there, and you can see these fountains here. And I think it's time to try out what it's like for myself. And to be honest, it's really quite refreshing because it's plus 30 outside at the moment, and it feels like 32. And to be honest, sorry, the water, oh my God, right, that was refreshing, but I almost drowned there. So yeah, I think the last joke is with Peter the Great, who got me well and truly with his trick fountains. Olga, where did the idea come from to create such a stunning landscape around us?
I think that initially the idea of creating an understandable, cultured space comes from ancient times. Having lived primarily in wild places, man sought to expand the boundaries of what was safe and understandable around him by creating a cultivated environment for himself, exemplifying human influence, human culture, and tamed nature. He expanded the safe boundaries of his own habitat. So, within the framework of the garden, man tried to recreate a model of the universe that he could understand, in a way he understood it at the time. Bacon called the garden the purest of human pleasures. Indeed, the garden is a reflection of an ideal world and what an ideal place can be. It's no accident that, as a reflection of earthly paradise, the garden is the most vivid image when we refer to some kind of afterlife or ideal world.
Tell me about the design process, Olga. How does it go from conception to realization?
The process of designing gardens is quite complicated, and this is no exception. The gardens of Peterhof, the regular upper and lower gardens, were the real brainchild of Peter the Great. Peter the Great himself took part in designing them, as evidenced by his handwritten drawings preserved in the archives. These are not full-fledged drawings, but light sketches where he outlined the main idea and concept, arranging the main elements. Besides, these drawings, records have been preserved, where Peter wrote in detail about what needed to be done at one time or another. In particular, he even paid attention to the planting of certain trees, the placement of certain pools. He often redrew the plans that architects proposed to him. Peter the Great made quite a lot of observations. Traveling through Europe repeatedly, he visited the best European ensembles, Hampton Court, Het Loo, Charlottenburg, Versailles, and many others. Therefore, he probably had a fairly clear idea of what he wanted to see. The project developed gradually. As for Peterhof Gardens, we cannot even say for sure which architect is fully responsible for the planning. Various architects contributed, but the final decision was left to Peter the First.
And when it comes to the plants, Olga, how do you go about choosing them? I can imagine that you have to take weather and climate into account when it comes to that.
If we're talking about the design of overall layout, no, the climate didn't much affect it, since it was created from various fairly large elements typical of all regular gardens. These are, of course, the reservoirs, an open parterre, and baskets surrounded by hedges. But the choice of what these elements were made of course, depended on the climate. For example, in Peter's time, they imported boxwood, which is widely used in Europe, from various European cities with trellises estimated to be tens of meters in length. But it didn't take root here. At the Menshikov estate, a rather curious and very rational solution was proposed for our climate. Rather than low-growing boxwood, they used lingonberries, which are usually very similar. While conifers, firs, and juniper are typically used in regular Russian gardens, the main tree for regular gardens here, as in Europe, remained linden, which was also brought here from Europe by the thousands. And these were already quite large trees.
Now, the upper garden, it has some certain similarities with a French park, and the geometry is just so precise. It seems that it's measured to the centimeter. How do you go about making it so precise and accurate?
These are very deep and complicated calculations. When restoring the parterres, all the dimensions were remeasured, literally with a ruler. They looked at their correspondence to parallels, perpendiculars, relative to each other. Even in the records on the first restoration of the upper garden, which took place in the 1920s, shortly after the revolution, they talked about planting marking poles to keep the parterre lines straight. That is, the straightness of the lines, this clear geometry, has been maintained throughout the history of the park.
And is it any easier now to do it with modern technology than it was back then?
I think so, but nevertheless, in maintaining any regular park, and even more so when restoring one, when we have a certain picture in our head of how we want it to turn out, to restore the appearance of this garden to how it looked almost 200 years ago, I think it's still very difficult.
I'm not surprised. Is it true, Olga, that in the 18th century there were vegetable gardens instead of flower beds, and even fish were farmed in some of the fountains?
This is partly true. According to the long-standing tradition of the royal gardens in Izmailova and Kolominskaya, they have also served a utilitarian purpose from the 17th century onwards. But their beauty was not sacrificed to make them useful, because first and foremost, the gardens were a way of representing the power of their most august owner. Therefore, the utilitarian parts of the garden were combined quite rationally with its ceremonial appearance. So the beds of the strawberries and asparagus, which we know existed in the uppermost garden even at the end of the 18th century, were located either on the periphery of the garden, not far from its fence, or inside baskets fenced with trellises. Fruit plantings were also located inside baskets. These were cherry and pear trees, barberries, gooseberries, currants, and other berries, as well as shrubs. Separate farm plots were also located in the lower garden. One surrounds a large greenhouse, and the other is not far from the Marley Palace. And records confirm that, at least until the mid-18th century, there really were fish in the ponds of the lower garden. These were fish specially raised to supply the royal table.